Shrink Wrap Radio number 344, Archetypal Phenomena Surrounding Death, with Jungian analyst Monica Wickman.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is author and Jungian analyst, Dr. Monica Wickman, who previously was my guest on episodes 286 on Jungian active imagination and number 235, using alchemical archetypes in Jungian analysis. Today we'll be discussing dreams and other archetypal events surrounding death. For more detail on her background, please visit our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. A Jungian analyst and author of Pregnant Darkness, Alchemy and the Rebirth of Consciousness, and various articles in Jungian psychology journals. Monica obtained her BA from UC San Diego and her doctorate from the California School of Professional Psychology in San Diego, where her research took her deep into the study of dreams of people with terminal cancer. After teaching graduate students at California State University, Los Angeles, she graduated as a diplomat from the Jung von Franz Center for Depth Psychology in Zurich. She lectures internationally on mythology and symbolism, dreams and wellness, alchemy and creativity. In private practice as a Jungian analyst and astrologer, she lives along a creek and under starry skies in Tesca, New Mexico, with horses, dogs, and friends. Now here's the interview. Dr. Monica Wickman, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. I'm happy to be back.
Yeah, it's so great to have you on again. You're one of my favorite guests, and so I'm really glad to have you here. And I understand you've just recently returned from a workshop in Ireland that you gave on dreams and other phenomena surrounding the dying experience. How'd that workshop go?
Well, actually, I ended up doing a workshop that had something to do with peril and renewal in individuation, which includes that edge of life and death. And I didn't get as far into that material on death as I had planned, although I do give that workshop regularly. I ended up getting more into the subtle body phenomenon that is the medium and material from which we experience these phenomena that do surround death.
Okay, well, you'll have a chance here to go into some of the material that you didn't get around to in Ireland. And so how did you come to be interested in the topic of phenomena surrounding death? My guess is that the interest probably grew out of some of your own personal experiences.
Yes, Dr. Dave, that's completely true. I think about in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, where Jung says that one ought to be close to death to have the freedom to talk about it. And I feel that in myself. I've been, for whatever reasons, and it's not a shining badge, it's actually been an arduous part of my life experience. I have been close to death a number of times and on the borderland a number of times in my life. And that has that happened to me very young, early on at 24. It was the first time when I had ovarian cancer, and I had a long 4-year road of dealing with ovarian cancer. It was stage 4, and wow. Yeah, prognosis that at one point turned into 2 weeks to live, and that put me really, you know, at the mercy of the psyche and of working with the psyche. And thank God for Jung's work in the world. I had good analysts who helped me access the psyche and work with dreams to help me in the process, thinking, of course, that I was likely going to die given the diagnosis. And so anyway, that's the first time that I encountered it, and I have other times in my life as well. I'm sure I'll sprinkle certain stories throughout our talk today from that time.
So at age 24, you were seeing a Jungian analyst already?
Yes, I had the great fortune of getting a lightning bolt awareness when I was at UCSD in undergraduate that the rat labs was not the kind of psychology I actually interested in.
Right.
Yes.
Many of us discover that at some point.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Oh, boy. And they, of course, the UCSD was the hot spot for behaviorism at the time and all this. I had to laugh. I was finding myself there, of course, longing for Jung. So when I happily got into graduate school, I immediately dive bombed for working in a Jungian analysis. And thank God I did, because that was the place that really held me as I went through the process of discovering I had very serious life-threatening cancer. But yes, I was interested in Jung in graduate school, and there were professors who taught it in the clinical psychology program I was in, and that was a real blessing.
Well, you sent me some more or less random notes prior to this, and I'm going to more or less randomly try to touch on some of the topics. And
okay.
One thing that you referred to was that you used dreams to help when you were diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer. So I'm wondering, how do dreams help?
Oh, good. I think that's a great place to start. First of all, when you think about where, like this, what is this doorway that exists between dimensions of reality? And dreams so track and open us to that doorway. In times of need, we cry out and the psyche gets a chance, the ego consciousness gets a chance to reach out beyond the domination of rationality. And I clearly was thrown in, and people get thrown into initiatory processes with the psyche that allows the center of ego consciousness to cry out for a larger experience of something of the self, of something of higher power, of something of other realms of consciousness that can help in healing. And dreams are, of course, a real gateway. We think about Freud saying it's the royal road to the unconscious. Well, I think it's really the kind of a numinous flaming doorway. And you think about, this is my roundabout way of dropping into the dream piece, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
But there's a beautiful few lines of Yeats that I love so much, of W.B. Yeats, the Irish poet who really led the Celtic revival in Ireland. And his lines, he says, "We who still labor by the cromlech on the shore and the great cairn on the hill, when the day sinks drowned in dew, growing weary of the world empires, bow down to you, master of the still stars and of the flaming door." And I think where our culture sits is exactly in this place. We are tired and weary of these world empires, and we are seeking culturally, collectively, some relationship of what can help us and assist us in a deeper existence and in transmutations and transformations. And so where our culture sits, we individuals have initiatory processes that throw us into needing to find what is this flaming door. It's so provocative. Mm-hmm. And dreams really help us find a way with that. This, as the alchemists called it, the finestra aeternitatis, the window to eternity. And sounds a bit like Harry Potter there with Jung using all the Latin. But this flaming door, this doorway, this window to eternity, that may sound lofty, but it's not. Of course, in the time space continuum, a big part of us is traveling with consciousness in time, space, world. And what we find is that dreams help us access beyond time and space and help us in a healing crisis. So that was true for me. When I was sitting there at 24, before I knew I had cancer, I did have a dream that absolutely announced it. Mm. And it was an awesome dream. When I look back on it, I end up realizing just amazing the amount of intelligence that lives in the psyche that can come to assist us.
Yes.
And basically a piece of the dream was that there was a doctor who I was talking to in the dream. And he said, "Listen, I'm sorry. You know, I know that you just came to draw blood, but I'm actually have to do a hysterectomy." And I, in the dream, was incredibly upset by this, and was talking to him about, what are you talking about? How can this be? And then he said, "But don't take it as personally, because there really are two wombs, and you still have the other one." And then I could see that there was this womb made of some kind of subtle essence that I still would have after this hysterectomy. Well, I had no idea that I had ovarian cancer. And so I had the dream, and it just a synchronicity would happen. I was going in for a regular, exam after this. And just a regular checkup exam, and the doctor immediately said, you know, you have to go in for exploratory surgery. Something's wrong. And I immediately flashed on the dream. And that, of course,
what was the length of time separating those two events?
Like 2 weeks.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Like a couple weeks. And it really helped me feel held, because it let me know something of the psyche could see me before I could see where I stood. Mm-hmm. And also that it could speak to me, it could image it. And of course, I knew then that that's where I would be turning to find a way to make it through that process a step at a time, reaching out for help from the dream world that could see the process that I was engaged in.
And were there, in fact, other dreams that helped you through that process?
Yes. You know, it's something I think about, Dr. Dave, the last time we talked, we were talking about Jung as a wounded healer. And I would hope that most of us Jungians get into the path via that exact archetype. And that's certainly my path. I went into the whole of this by absolute need. And the becoming a Jungian analyst is based completely on what unfolded for me starting in my early 20s when these dreams unfolded. And it was step for step, dream for dream, finding the way. If I didn't have the dream path, I don't know what would have happened to me. I assume I would have died, because I didn't have the ability to access a larger point of view and larger energy field that could help heal my physical body and also other parts to the psyche body in me that were really in trouble. So yes, it was a dream path that unfolded a step at a time.
Can you perhaps share one of the dreams that was particularly important along that path?
Yes, there's a whole string of pearls of them that I hold as really dear to myself that are like prayer beads for me. And they helped me feel a map of reality and a sense of something with me that was going to help me in the passage if I was dying. And so I think what I'll do probably is name a few as we go through the hour.
Okay.
And mention one to you now. And this one happened when I was on, I was in the hospital. I had come out of the surgery and the doctors were afraid to tell me how bad it was. And so they had told me kind of partial truth or reality about it. They told me, you know, you have ovarian cancer and it's, you know, really serious. And it's a virulent strain, and we tried to get out as much out of your body as we could. And then I went back, of course, into the anesthesia, painkillers, and the process of trying to get even just coherent in the hospital. And then this was days later when it was starting to dawn on me what actually was happening, and I was about to be released from the hospital. The night before getting released to go home, I dreamt that I was in a tunnel and a dark tunnel, and I was moving through the tunnel. This is kind of classic near-death phenomenon. Many people report this. It just happens to be my own experience. But I was in the tunnel, and I had my hands around a little candle flame, and there was a feminine being standing behind me who had her arms around me and around the candle flame. And she said to me, as we were moving through the tunnel, "Whatever you do, don't let the candle flame go out." And with that came the awareness that we were holding this candle flame together, and that I could, in fact, try to turn around in the tunnel with her help. So I turned around back toward, where I had come from the light source behind me. And when I woke up, I felt the presence of that feminine being and its ability to have its arms around me, help guard my little flame of life force, and also help me try to turn back toward life. And it helped me really feel the presence of what would guide me through either living or dying. So I know throughout the whole time, Dr. Dave, the thing I kept feeling was, I can do this as long as I'm not alone. And I don't mean alone with human beings, because I was in a time when I was quite alone in my life, but alone in the psyche. If I had help in the psyche, then I could do this.
Yeah.
Either way.
Wow. What a powerful dream. Now, you mentioned earlier, before the interview, that you had drawn also on research on dreams of the dying at the UCSD Medical Center, as well as from your own clinical work with the dying. So I'm interested in touching on those two sources. I was not aware of a database of research on dreams of the dying.
Well, what I did, it makes me laugh now thinking about it, because I'm far from doing this at this point in my life. But after I wrestled with cancer for 4 years and had a gift of spontaneous remission, as they say, or an outpouring of grace or contact with the psychoidal. It left my body overnight after a 2-week prognosis. I had this healing experience. And then after that, I started to realize that I was going to be living my life. I didn't have cancer anymore, and I haven't had cancer since, and it's many years since. What happened about 4 years after that is I had got this flaming arrow in my quiver talking to me about wanting to do research on dreams of the dying, because I had finished my master's and I wanted to go back and finish my clinical PhD. So I went to UCSD Medical Center to conduct the research and San Diego Hospice. And I did my research at these facilities and collected the dreams from people who were dying. And they had a cancer prognosis and diagnosis that left them with 6 months or left to live. That was the criteria for being part of the study. And there were 35 people who had that prognosis, and then I had 35 people who were part of my control group, and I collected 1,500 dreams.
Oh, my goodness. That's a lot of dreams.
That's why I laugh when you ask me about it now. I think, who was it that did this? I gathered 1,500 dreams and then looked at them from a number of different perspectives, and then the group sorted out by multiple regression which dreams were stronger in which. And the work of Anne France was behind me. I had written her, and she'd written back, and her book on dreams of death had just come out while I was designing this, and I decided to see if she would help me at all. And so I was looking at certain motifs that would show up in dreams. First of all, an intensification of the psyche in people who are ill and who have that kind of diagnosis, that they're dreaming more with more intensity, longer dreams, more dreams, and the archetypal intensity in the dreams was higher. All of that bode completely true.
Wow. And, great findings.
Yes, it was a lot of fun. I had a lot of help too along the way. I just want to thank all the people who helped me. And then also there were archetypal motifs in the dreams that also appeared stronger in the cancer group than in the people without cancer in the control group. And motifs of transition, Jung's work and von Franz's work has spoken about that motifs in dreams of the dying often show river crossings, water crossings, initiatory processes, baptisms, bridges. There were certain motifs like that I went looking for, and different variables that showed up higher in the people with cancer. So that all did come out actually quite strongly. And then the specific dreams actually were the part that becomes more interesting. You end up watching then these themes getting worked out in a dream series, for example. And watching the person making peace with, at some very deep level, the reality of death. This is what interests me now when I look back on the research. I definitely appreciate, Jung certainly has his empirical scientist side and his shamanic side, his wounded healer side. And I think this phenomenological side of ourselves that wants to look at actual raw data and see if we can sort it out and see differences between people who are under deep initiatory experiences with death and those who aren't. It is interesting to see how the differences pan out. And one of the processes I mentioned is to see dream series that show people making actual peace with death. And I actually also saw this in my grandmother. My grandmother was dying at the same time, and this was very meaningful to me because she let me be close to her while she was in the process of death. And I feel her very strongly, and my love for her as I talked to you about it. She was Irish and Welsh, and she had, interestingly, had ovarian cancer. Now, ovarian cancer never ran in my family, she ended up getting it after I had it, which is odd.
Yes.
But there she was in her 70s with this. And so anyway, the dream process that took her through showed this outrageously painful terror and anxiety about having to face death. And it would show her up on a cliff and something extremely dangerous and deadly approaching her, and her just, you know, terrified and trying to figure out where to hide. And this figure that kept approaching in the dream slowly transformed over time. I'd say in about 6 to 8 months, that figure slowly changed and her anxiety toward death changed. And as that being changed, it turned into literally a sister of mercy. It turned into this felt presence that had tremendous compassion, that loved and knew her like no one else, that was there to take her into her arms. And she ended up being able to feel in the end that death was something mysterious that she could welcome. And believe me, her psychology, she started from such a different place. If you don't mind, I'll tell you also a dream I had of her when she died.
Yes, I would love to hear that. And I was just thinking that I think that your being with her and drawing her out, I guess, about sharing her dreams and being there for her must have helped that process and that transition to happen.
You know, I'm so grateful that she was kind of gruff, and she had some kind of rough sides to her personality, and the older she got, they were very strong. And I'm really glad that she had the chutzpah to call me on the phone and say, I unplugged myself from the dialysis machine. If you want to see me, I'll be gone in 72 hours. And of course, that was typical of her. So I called my father, who lived in Denver, and said, listen, you know, catch an airplane ticket that I've reserved for you. Let's meet in Phoenix and let's get out there and let's be with her. So he came, and we're both so grateful that we did that. I can't tell you. I mean, it just incredibly important that we both were there.
And you know, I've had a couple of experiences with colleagues who had very rough edges, people who I didn't particularly like, and then they had to deal with some serious illness, and it really softened them and really changed them and transformed them in a way that you know, that they were much more humble and approachable.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I think about von Franz speaking to that too, that the most authentic relationship that we often get with the psyche and with ourselves and with life comes from tremendous suffering, to initiatory energies that, you know, really take us into something that purifies us, purifies those states of being. It's true. My grandmother, definitely some of the gnarly aspects of her, my father and I did really watch as she moved through her death process too. We do get tenderized by life completely, don't we? We're all on the same field. We're all on the same ground.
Yeah, I like that, tenderized. So you were about to share a dream that you had during that period.
Yeah, when my grandmother was dying, my father and I were in the room with her, and we really just sang to her, spoke to her, met whatever kind of state of consciousness she was in. And when she'd ask for help, we'd try to help her in whatever way she wanted us to. And I know that the music and song singing really helpful, also touch, very helpful. And I know people do this, you know, regularly now for those who are dying all the time. But here we are, what we were finding our own way with it. And the process of her actual death, when she was actually dying, I had put my head back in the room and immediately I had this vision and dream, because I'd fallen asleep with my head against the wall. I was so tired. And I dreamt that, that quote, God, which was this interesting, was male, interesting, and he came in from the right, and he was in a subtle body state, his figure not so exactly clear, but of subtle body material and light, and stepped in on the right and said to me, I've come for my lover, my beloved. And I said, which is really funny, I said, oh, I'll tell the doctors. And of course, and then I laughed. I said, oh my God, this is so beyond the doctors. I don't have to tell the doctors. And then I was sort of laughing at myself and kind of trying to catch up with this. And so this figure is walking toward my grandmother's, you know, bed is in the hospice center. And he's walking over to where she is. And his arms reached out. And I say, oh, but wait, God, you know, when you say your lover, your beloved, I remember when she was beautiful and her eyes were sparkling blue and her hair gorgeous and her skin so lovely and her presence so strong. And I remember her countenance so well. And how is it now you call her your beloved, your lover? And I got this in the dream, I got this big shh. and kind of a hand that moved me to the side, a little gesture that moved me to the side, and then a smile, and the message then came through, which was, shh, this is perfect preparation for becoming my lover, my beloved. And then scooped her, and believe me, she had no teeth, and she smelled, of course, she was dying, and her hair was, you know, in every direction, and her face sunken, and as death does to us. So he sweeps her up into his arms and absorbs her in a field of love right into his whole, you know, body field, and holds her, and then vanishes and is gone. And when I woke up, she had died.
Mm, wow. You know, the relevant here might be something that you put in your notes. Mm-hmm. You said suspending belief and disbelief when working with dreams of the dying.
Yes.
What are you getting at there?
Oh, it's really important. It's actually the cornerstone to this. My childhood faith had blown apart as I had worked in analysis, and that was one of the things that had gone. And being contained by any of the world religions in a dogmatic way, very few people are these days. And even when people are, the psyche seeks to free them to get a bigger sense that's not static. And so, you know, belief in an afterlife or belief in God never gets us anywhere. And whatever that does, it stands in the way, actually. I think to take the agnostic, the not knowing position, I think the fixity comes in as if we think we know or as if we don't know. So it's to totally believe or mm-hmm. to absolutely declare there absolutely isn't is a very rationalistic approach that is not the reality with the mythopoetic imagination. And we're starved for the mythopoetic imagination in our world. In fact, this whole Western culture with the, you know, Descartes and this Cartesian dualism and the rationalistic, something's always on the throne of consciousness in a culture. And we've had rationalism there forever, which kills off anything to do with the imagination and the imaginal. So, but what's going on underneath each psyche, and what's going on under mine, and it's under every one of us, is that there is this, reservoir of the unconscious that is alive and well in the depths of the human psyche, of the human soul, and it is infinitely capable of regenerating itself and coming up inside our own human experiences. I think actually a quote of Jung's here is just really perfect when he says my work is one of taking the fixed thought forms of world religions and melting them down and pouring this melted substance into the molds of individual experience.
What a great quote.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's his work. And it's his work in a nutshell, isn't it? And it's our work with the psyche. So that's beyond belief and disbelief, and it's beyond fixity and dogma that in the individual human soul lives this living poetic force field of the imaginal that's infinitely capable of rebirthing us. And it does it through imagery. Now, my grandmother, of course, was Irish Catholic, so it fit that it came in looking like this in that dream, sure. which did make me laugh. And it's also very interesting to look at every world religion. Behind each world religion are these mystical traditions. You know, there's the mystics behind the Christian tradition, behind Judaism, behind Islam, and ancient cultures, the whole reality of Taoism. Alchemy is a complete compensation behind Christianity that happened in the West, and you know, it was in Egypt as well. So there are ways that the mythopoetic imagination is busy rebirthing us using its force fields and imagery that's beyond these fixed thought forms. And that's what I mean by getting beyond belief and disbelief. Because I think if we think we believe in something, we're in the way of it. The mind puts a fantasy out onto the psyche and onto experience, and that doesn't work. And then if we do the opposite, we can block experiences. But
yeah, that's beautifully stated. Now, earlier you mentioned a near-death experience that you had. And so what's the relationship between dreams and NDAs, near-death experiences?
Well, if you work with your dreams, it can really help you to be open and more conscious to be able to track when you're having near-death experiences. So that is it's like literally exercising a muscle. It's a part of us that can learn to be aware and hold consciousness around this field, this phenomenological field of where symbols and images come from. So I think for people who have near-death experiences, you know, many people have them, but they don't remember them and how sad that is. So they come back, they don't remember what happened. But if you can remember it, come back, then you have a solid sense of presence and even a teaching that came to you through you about why you're still in your incarnation. So dreams are a way to learn how to tend that border between worlds and also have an easier time when it comes to either literally dying or getting into near-death experiences. That was certainly true for me, and it's certainly been true for people I've worked with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my buddies, when he was in graduate school, studied near-death experiences and out-of-the-body experiences. And one of his main findings, interviewing people who had had those kinds of experiences, was that people who have had those experiences no longer fear death.
Boy, that's exactly true. I find that to be so, so true. And that's, I guess, bodes with what we're talking about when dreams show a series through time of people who are dying. You can see literally some part that's working hard to find peace with the process. And that is important. I mean, it's not a cookbook and it's not a morality and it's not a dogma about having to be at peace with death. People can go any way they need to or want to. It's an easier way to birth yourself out of this life. To find a way. It's a bit like, you know, if a bunch of fetuses were sitting around together and they said, "We don't know where we're going, but it helps to put your head down." I'm like, I think it's similar, you know, when we're leaving this life, we have no idea. It's a giant mystery, but it evidently helps to relate to the phenomenon of death, relate to dreams and the imaginal field that can help us cry out for help, reach out for help and find it, assist us. And then, of course, making peace helps us in the birthing process when we leave life.
Yeah. I want to go back to that magical period that you mentioned where you had been given a 2-week death sentence. And then somehow you went into complete remission. Was there any experience, any internal or archetypal experience around that to announce it, herald it, guide you through it? What happened?
Yeah, gosh. You know, I have recent experiences, too, of having been sick recently in the past 3 years, and I seem to end up working on this borderland, so I'm thinking of those as well. Well, when this happened back in the 80s, I had had many dreams, of course, throughout the process that really were guiding me, and I stayed on a really good diet, which most people do these days, you know, just trying to bring consciousness up. And, you know, since life's about awakening, I was busy. I knew that this was a crisis of awakening, no matter what, live or die. It was about working to save, quote, my life. Whether I died or didn't die, I needed to really wake up. And so I was busy doing that in every medium I could think of, and yoga and diet and changing my life in radical ways, changing relationship patterns. I moved to Colorado to live in Crested Butte in the middle of nowhere because I knew that was going to be part of the monk life that would help me heal. I got a horse. So I was doing all this at the same time as I had stage 4 ovarian cancer. And I and had a process of dreams telling me also to kind of step by step to get out of the treatment. The treatment was not helping me. The medical results were very clear that chemotherapy was not helping me, and it was horrific at that time. For stage 4 ovarian cancer, it was cytoxins, cisplatin, and adriamycin, all just killer chemicals. So you don't want to take that if it's not working.
Definitely.
So anyway, it was dreams that actually were speaking to me and with a real deep inner authority that got me out of doing this. And the reason I go to this when you ask me about what happened in the very end is that it was a constant building of an inner authority presence that was bigger than my ego and bigger than self-doubt and bigger than orientation of, you know, positive psychology or trying to conjure confidence or courage. Beyond any of that, this inner authority of the self was growing behind things, and it helped me. Literally, I was riding the elevator to go to the hospital to take the 6th treatment of chemotherapy, and I think and as I was riding the elevator, I heard this voice say, "You're not doing this. You're done." And it was so strong. It was so strong and so centered a voice. That its authority I really could not debate. I stepped off the elevator and went, "Oh my God, I'm not doing this." So I went to tell the doctors, "I'm not doing this." And they had said, "Well, listen, you might be having a breakdown." I said, "Well, that's fine, but I'm still not doing this. And I still want the medical tests because I still want to keep track as like biofeedback to know how the cancer is doing. And I'd like to use other mediums and see what might happen." So that's what I did. I end up still using the medical tests. So when I was living in Colorado and had gotten extremely sick, I'd gotten to where I knew that it had gotten much worse. It was very clear. And I decided to go back and get some tests in San Diego. So I went back to San Diego and I could hardly stay awake. I had headaches. I couldn't eat. I mean, it was very clear I was fading. And I was 28 at the time, and it was fourth year into this process. And I remember going to the doctor's office, and Dr. White in San Diego was a second opinion person telling me the same thing for the second time that day, that you have about 2 weeks to live. This is where the CA125 markers are, and this is it. So my partner at the time, Ray Hillis, drove me into the desert. I had said, let's just drive all night into New Mexico. Let's just get out under the stars. Let's just get out on the open road while we get some room to breathe. And we didn't own a place in New Mexico at the time. We ended up buying a place later in New Mexico, which is where I still live. But we drove all night. We ended up, without knowing it, on the edge of the Hopi and Navajo Nation. We parked under the stars in the back of a pickup truck, and poor Ray was very tired. I suddenly woke up, and when I woke up, I realized that, oh my God, I wasn't going to be awake much longer, that I was so exhausted by the whole process of this, and I was just digesting the news I'd gotten in San Diego. And so what I did is, of course, what people have done throughout time, and it's highly recommendable, which is cry out. Talk about humble ground. In my mind's eye, I think about an image in Egypt, from ancient Egypt, that shows the supplicant who's in the process of dying, and she's beautifully down on her knees with her nose at the river of life, and on the other side is the god Sobek, who's going to help her in the passage. And I mean, this is an archetypal reality for all of us. As soon as this boundary between life and death appears, where we ought to be finding that religious attitude that Jung so deeply speaks about, and get to the water of life, get down on our hands and knees and ask for help. And there I was crawling, crying out in the inside my heart and soul in the back of the truck as Ray was sleeping. And I had my dog at my feet, Kiva, a little husky wolf pup, a red husky wolf pup at my feet. And as I cried out, I was just saying, I can't do this alone. And I suddenly feel very alone. The full 4 years, I felt these presences that were there to help me. And in this moment, I didn't know where that presence had gone. And I just was crying out for help. And in my mind's eye, too, I was thrashing. I was saying, oh, I could get back to the cabin and I could do more of the diet and yoga and, all the rationalizing that goes on for all of us at this border of, I could still apply more energy. And of course, there was no more energy to apply. The ego was completely defeated. Mm-hmm. There was nothing left I could do. And so then I started calling out to the goddess in every name I could think of. And as I did that, this presence, I felt a presence with me. And then a whole field of the subtle body, a visionary field inside the subtle body state, appeared for me and gave me a series of visions and a series of messages and experiences, one by one, by one, by one. And I thought as they were unfolding, now I had never done any hallucinogens. But I had done all this dream work. So I was prepared to be present to this. I'd done act imagination. I'd been working with the subtle body and act imagination and dreams. So when these visions came, I knew to take a deep breath, stay present for them, that it was really something very important not to be anxious of. And so as it unfolded, the message was to surrender. At one point, I saw this giant scarab beetle sitting in front of me, floating in front of me. And the message was to make peace with the spirit of this creature, and down into the earth it went, and it called me also to go with it down into the earth. And once I was down in under the earth, it was this energy field that was breaking apart everything. It's like what death was, and it breaks apart everything and became one with everything. And suddenly everything I was getting ecstatically released, and it was tremendous freedom, tremendous light, a feeling of peace. Sound and vibration came out of this, and this whole field of sound and vibration started just emanating and grew, and a series of other visions then came in. Now, I thought with my rational mind that was looking in on this, the observer was saying, well, you're dying and this is the death process, and just go through all of this if you can, and if you can, come out of it at the end and wake Ray up and tell him what happened so everybody you love knows that death is not to be feared, and that they know that your death wasn't to be feared, and in fact was beautiful, that much met you in the passage. So that was my heart's intent as this was unfolding. And at one point, a certain creature came with the light force field and lit up my subtle body and all the chakras, and my body was lit up, and I could see it lit up in my then partner Ray, and I could see it in my dog Kiva, and I looked out under the night sky, and I could see liquid silver drops, the divine feminine raining out of the sky and dropping into all of matter, and all of matter was black and dead. But once this drops of silver dropped into it all, it all took on an ecstatic hum and a music and a subtle body state. It all went into an ecstatic reverie, and it took on the sound tone of Om and just echoing, resounding. And of course, this was all so big, the perception so beyond the time-space world, so beyond my little mortal ego, who's getting news and wondering if she's going to live. It was such a field of energy, so healing and so big. I really thought I was dying. So when I came out of this, I, of course, woke Ray up and told him every piece of what had happened so that he could commit it to memory, because I found it to be so beautiful. And he did. And, of course, I went to sleep. And then the next day, I actually woke up. I actually felt a little better. I felt like eating something for the first time. And slowly but surely, I got myself back to my cabin in Colorado, and then step by step came to take medical tests in Gunnison, and one by one found out that I, in fact, no longer had ovarian cancer.
Wow. What a story. What an experience.
You know, it's something, Dr. Dave, I think about Jung mentions in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections so exquisitely, that when people have near-death experiences and they come back, that what they report is that when we get to the other side, however it happens in this phenomenological reality, beings on the other side want to hear the story we lived in time-space world. And when I had these experiences, I realized, okay, yeah, that's true. But that's also true on this side of life. The stories that we're living and the depth of meaning in them and the depth of initiatory, you know, experiences and what our myths and lives are about, they're important on this side too.
Yeah, definitely. And just even to hear your experience is inspiring, and hopefully opens all of us who are listening to the possibility of being more open to that kind of experience for ourselves.
And thank you, too, for giving me a place to speak that story out. I do know there are many people with like stories. I'm amazed and moved to watch how the psyche is doing this. Mm-hmm. It wants to initiate us. It wants to break us open, and it wants to help us heal. Now, sometimes, of course, the healing comes, and the healing is also dying. And one can never know about this. I've worked with people so long, and I hesitate to talk about my own experience because it's hard for people where they get into the process and it does not end up being a complete recovery. Mm-hmm. Why this happened to me, I have, it's always a mystery. And but nonetheless, I think about Irv Yalom and his brilliant book, Love's Executioner, in that one chapter. I'm sure you've read that. Did you read that, Dr. Dave, The Love's Executioner?
I don't think I did. I interviewed him, but I don't think I read the book. Or if I did, it was a long time ago, and I don't quite remember it all.
Okay, well, that one is a real gem, I have to say. And he's got a story in there of working with a man who had cancer, and it's a very touching story. God, it's so touching. And in the end, the man, as he's dying, he says to Irv, "Thank you for saving my life."
Yeah, you know, one way that's come through to me is Jerry Jampolsky, somebody else who I've interviewed and have kind of known a little bit, started something he called the Center for Attitudinal Healing. Mm-hmm. And just the title kind of carries a message that was very meaningful to me. And it's kind of just what you were getting at, that the healing may not be a physical healing.
Exactly.
But that there can be a kind of healing, even if the person ends up dying, there can be a healing of attitude, of spiritual woundedness, if you will.
I so agree. I so agree. And I think there's something, too, about, of course, most of us would like, in these incarnational choice points, we'd like to make a choice to live longer. And you and I could actually spend another hour talking about these incarnational choice points where we can watch the psyche of people approach this threshold in different ways at different times of loss. And when we get sick or we face death, there's a big place in the psyche and the soul of us that's trying to decide whether to choose life or not. And that's a huge part of course. An important part. And there's also parts that are so deeply mysterious that are operating. And the part about surrender either way, regardless of outcome, reaching out for the presence of these deep healing experiences, regardless of outcome. I so agree. And that's actually where it took me. I truly did not think I was going to be living at that point. I had to deeply surrender. And I think something in the psyche loves us to surrender that deeply.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, that's a mouthful.
Yeah. You noted in the notes that you sent me that other cultures have a sense of those who die that function as ancestors. And yes. So there's this whole area of ancestors and whether or not the people who appear to us in our dreams are communicating from the other side, or is that just an inner projection? And I just finished teaching a course on dreams for a lifelong learning program at Sonoma State. And that was one of the questions that came up, you know, that some people were asking about, well, what about when people who've died appear to us?
Yes.
In our dreams. So I'm going to toss that ball to you.
Okay. Well, you know, when we suspend belief and disbelief and we really go with a phenomenological approach, we really end up then being open to how much of this phenomenon is actually happening. And to watch, and I think every person, you think about every person, to be able to take in what your own experiences are in dream time and synchronicity phenomenon, to take in what your experiences are and to generate out of that something of your sense of where you sit in the cosmos and what's the nature of the cosmos, what's the nature of reality. Every being must, you know, play with that and answer that for themselves, of course. And so when we do that, we end up really finding people often dream of those that have deceased. And when you listen to the motifs and themes, I mean, it's pure soul music. And there's qualities that keep coming back around and again. And this is what came through my dream research and also my work with the dying for so long, is that there are motifs that keep appearing that bring us peace. So oftentimes, you're right, we will see somebody who has died and they'll come in and say, for example, I'm on special dispensation. You know, and also that you can't touch me, but I've come to share something of importance with you. And they'll come and they'll have something to say. I have many dreams collected that has this motif in it. And I know when we start to listen, we really catch that. There are oftentimes, too, when you linked it with that first question, too, about ancient cultures have had a sense about this, not in a sentimental way. Not in a Pollyanna way and not in something trite. It's deep inside their ancestral knowing and ancestral memory that as they build culture through time, they have a sense of where the ancestors, you know, go on and reside in some other time-space dimension. Now, this physics now has opened the portal to this. We now know, of course, with physics that there are many dimensions. And, you know, Jung's work about the psyche is completely beyond the time-space locality. One part of it is extending itself into the time-space world, but its intensity goes way beyond it goes way beyond into intensity beyond time-space. We could get a whole discussion on that, but the part about the ancestors comes up in Taoism very strongly. It comes up in the native tribes that live in my backyard all along the Tewa, along the Rio Grande, the Tewa and Tewa tribes and Towa tribes. They all have sense about their ancestors, that as people die, they take up residence in another dimension, that they are then guardians, guides, and helpers. And some of them. Now you have to, you know, which ones they're going to end up having a felt connection to is always a mystery. And it comes through dreams and it comes through synchronistic phenomenon. So in other words, it's phenomenology of connection to them. It's not just a belief that this will happen. It's like, well, did you dream or did you get a felt sense? And felt sense is very, very important when we're getting into this material, because felt sense can get highly refined. So you listen to people who are having dreams of ancestors who've died. If you ask them to stay with the dream material, they start to get a felt sense of what's happening inside it. And a parent, for example, who's died early on in a young child's life, if that child can get a dream of that parent in any way, shape, or form, it can bring incredible bridging and comfort. So the use of these in psychotherapy is beyond helpful. It's there's nothing like it. It's really the transcendent function. But sometimes you get something that feels more like an archetype or a symbol or the presence of or a memory. That's part of felt sense. And then part of felt sense is, no, that feels like the actual presence of them in another dimension. Mm-hmm. And it's learning to differentiate through felt sense. What is it? So that I think is important, and it's an art that we take to this, working with the phenomenon of dreams and death, is to develop and refine this felt sense.
So did you say that it seemed to be a theme that when the ancestors do appear, when somebody who's passed on appears, that they're generally delivering a message of peace and comfort?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It works on both sides. So, for example, if you have someone that you know, or if it's ourselves that are dying, oftentimes we'll be having dreams of those who have died, who are coming across to be of some help. My ex-husband Ray, when he was with his father at his father's death, his father's last dream report was that his deceased wife had come and said, "I'm on special dispensation, Howard. Please pack your suitcase." That was his last dream. Wow. Now he had no sense of dreams. He'd never reported a dream. This is also what's extraordinary about asking those we love when they're dying, what are you dreaming? Because it will all come out. And I really say that for your listeners, because a lot of us will be with people that we love. And if you're present at the deathbed of anyone we love, to just say, "Have you had a dream? What are you dreaming?" Or also if they come out of kind of a coma state, "Where were you? What did you dream?" And just let them speak it out loud. It doesn't have to be interpreted. The medicine is in it. It's very clear. There was a woman who worked with me in San Diego who had one of these. It was so touching. Her father, who repaired satellites his whole life and was completely a sensation type and a technician and would make fun of anything to do with psychology or anything to do with spirituality for sure. On his deathbed, she asked him a dream. And he said, "Everyone quiet. There's a very, very, very special guest here." Mm. And of course she just, I mean, there it was. So yeah. So you see how through the imaginal window, that window to eternity, if we can open it at all, it's the simplest thing. That's why dreams are so unbelievably helpful. Near-death phenomenon too, that's a little more dramatic, but dreams will do it too. And so, yes, it happens for those who are dying. And then also, when we've had someone die, to have dreams of them from the other side who have a message for us that can bring incredible peace. And there are numerous ones of these that people have had. Von Franz speaks of one of her father coming after he died, Marie-Louise von Franz Jung's right hand, when she speaks about her father after he died. He came to let her know, he tells her, that he was carrying on the same work that he didn't get done this lifetime, and he wanted her to know that. So that all of the heartbreak she'd gone through in trying to deal with him, he was delivering this message. "Listen, I want you to know it's consolation here. Everything you were seeing, basically, the gist of the message was, you know, what you were seeing, I'm working on the other side." And so oftentimes there are messages and presences. I have a someone I've known who lives in the South who has experiences when a child that died, a grandmother that keeps coming in. The grandmother keeps coming in to talk to her about her child that had died. And it is bringing her peace step by step to see these dreams.
What about your own grandmother? Did you have dreams about your own grandmother or your grandmother appearing to you after she had passed?
I have, and that's been... you know, it's a I don't know what I would do without the dream window. I must be one of the densest people on the planet. I need it. You think about the alchemists, they're always trying to work to take what's dense and make it subtle. So without dreams, I'd probably be just getting the dense award. My grandmother has come in through dreams and has really then functions as a helper to me. I can feel her. It's like the Russian iconography where you'd see those old images of Mary and the Christ would be living in her heart chakra. I can feel literally in the heart center my grandmother's presence, and it's like a compass. I can feel her. If you think of like it's like ability to read the feeling tone of something and tell me where I belong or don't belong, and it's become very specific. And I very much needed that. So this fits with Taoism, that the ancestors want to be helpers and take up a resonant field sometimes to help us, be with us. And I would never have thought that. I didn't believe in that. It just happens to be what happened. And I'm ever grateful. And I'm very grateful.
Yeah. In the notes that you sent me, you made reference to Stan Grof's picture book.
Oh, I have to.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a delightful interview with him, but I don't know what this picture book is that you're referring to.
Oh, I have to say, it's so beautiful. It's called Beyond Death, The Gates of Consciousness. And it is an exquisite collection of archetypal images that show us how death and this doorway, this flaming door, has been seen through the ages. And there are images from Blake, from Dore, every tradition you can think of is in there. And it's a must. It's a large book, you know, it's 8.5 by 11 at least. And it's called Beyond Death, The Gates of Consciousness, and then in parentheses, Art and Imagination by Stan Grof. It was done in 1980, and it is, in my sense of his work, all of his works are, you know, going to have a long, 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 long shelf life. And this one is, it goes through eternity. It's a beautiful collection.
Wow. I'm definitely going to be looking that up. Well, we're sort of reaching the point in the hour where it's probably time just to start winding down, although you open up so many flaming doorways that would be interesting to explore, and yeah. I hope that we will in future conversations. Are there any last words you'd like to leave our audience with?
Good point. I think that if you're deeply interested in this topic, to read von Franz's book on dreams and death, and her last chapter of the book particularly, where she talks about the psyche matter extension and how the body realizes itself. The psyche realizes the body at death and travels us out the time-space continuum. That chapter is exquisite, and that could be a whole nother you know, talk with you sometime if you wanted, but I would suggest people take a look at that. But mainly, it's that we leave our eyes open and hearts open, and know how to cry out for help, that true heart of the religious function that Jung was so after, and to ask those who are dying or sick, what are you dreaming? Because often it's that simple.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing so generously from your own experiences and your own learning. Really, really deep material. So, Dr. Monica Wickman, I want to thank you once again for being a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much, Dr. Dave. It was a joy.
Wow, it felt really great to connect with Dr. Monica Wickman again. I really like the fact that she's not only very knowledgeable, but also that she's very down to earth and open. And of course, I also appreciate the fact that she's very supportive of Shrink Wrap Radio and is very accessible as a guest. As a matter of fact, she suggested two topics right after the interview. I think one of them was about the new physics, which she kind of got into, and maybe the subtle energy body, and the other one is what she refers to as incarnation choice points. Well, you better believe I'll have her back on to talk about something, anything. During our conversation, an insight was triggered for me by something she shared. I'm not even sure what the specific trigger was, but I remembered a very significant dream in which I became lucid. The pre-lucid part was, I'm an actor in a play, and a phone rings on stage, which I guess is part of the action. But when I pick up the phone, it's my stepdad, who has been dead for some years, and he says, "The circle of your existence is about to come to a close." At that point, I become sufficiently lucid to have the thought, wow, maybe this really is my stepdad speaking to me from the other side. I get so excited by that realization that it pulls me out of the lucidity and the dream, and I wake up. Now that I've recorded this, I realize this dream memory must have been triggered when Monica and I were talking about dream ancestors, dreams of ancestors. The insight that's totally fresh for me, and let me say parenthetically, it's never been clear to me what that message about the circle of my existence is about to come to a close is about, since I have continued to live for quite a few more years. The insight is that, in fact, one of the biggest circles of my life was a long run of synchronicities which culminated in my finding my biological father. I believe this happened sometime after that dream, but I don't recall exactly by how much time. I think my stepdad was telling me I was close to finding my biological father. Wow, I've never put those two together before just now with Monica. I look forward to more such conversations with Dr. Monica Wickman, and I hope you do too.
My name is Grant Strine, and I practice clinical psychology in Havertown, Pennsylvania. After months of listening to Dr. Dave's spectacular interviews and noticing their positive effects in my personal and professional lives, I felt moved to offer a small token of monetary support. Not only did this extinguish any lingering guilt about not supporting, it boosted my mood for days. And I was so happy and pleasantly surprised to get a kind and thoughtful return email from Dr. Dave himself. Now I feel a profound satisfaction for being part of the Shrink Wrap Radio community.
Thanks again, Grant Strine, for that ringing endorsement. If others of you out there have helped to contribute financially to Shrink Wrap Radio, would you please send an audio clip stating what led you to do so? You can just leave a voicemail at 206-350-9918 or use your computer or smartphone or tablet to create a voice file and send it to me as an email attachment. Another way that people lend support is by transcribing selected episodes, and we have some new transcripts on the site. Number 341, The Hidden Psychology of Pain with James Alexander, which is a pretty recent one, and that was done for us by Gloria Ullman. So thank you once again, Gloria, who's done a number of these for us. And we also have an older one, number 233, NLP Modeling in Corporate Training with Tom Carroll. And that one is thanks to listener Simon Huggins, a longtime listener. Thanks a lot, Simon. You can probably hear in my voice that I'm still not fully recovered from that cold I reported a few weeks back. There's been a persistent residual cough. I've heard from a number of friends in this local area that have had a similar experience. I hope those of you who are listening don't catch it from me or from anyone else. Some of you might recall my reporting from the Second World Congress on Positive Psychology that was in Philadelphia 2 years ago. Well, the Third World Congress will be in Los Angeles this June, and I think I'm going to try to attend as a journalist again, if they'll let me. So I'll keep you updated on my plans. And welcome to any new listeners. I see new signups on a daily basis. If you are new, be sure to visit our website at shrinkwrapradio.com for information about CE units that you can earn just for listening to these interviews, plus a variety of other offers that you'll find on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com.
This is Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, founder of the Trauma Stewardship Institute and author of Trauma Stewardship, an Everyday Guide for Caring for Self While Caring for Others, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, who will be my next guest. More about that a bit later. First, let's go to some recent email and posted comments from our listener community. First, I thought I'd share a comment posted by my recent guest from Shrink Wrap Radio number 341, Dr. James Alexander, on the hidden psychology of pain. He wrote to give some additional clarification. James writes, "Hi, Dave. I remember in the interview you commenting that you hadn't thought of EMDR as being a depth psychology approach, and I don't think I arrived at a comment on the issue. So, as a follow-up, yes, I know that Shapiro was really coming from a behavioral stance when she came across the importance of bilateral stimulation." Now, he's talking about Francine Shapiro, who was the originator of EMDR. And he goes on to say, "However, as I stated in my book, I think she managed to create an amalgam of the best elements of all the other types of psychology, including depth psychology. An EMDR session often sounds very much like the free association of psychoanalysis. There's usually no interpretation, judgment, or discussion, but each new item to enter a person's field of awareness is followed by a set of eye movements. In addition, the material which invariably comes up during an EMDR session is from the person's unconscious. The process itself seems to facilitate access to unconscious material very easily and quickly. This then becomes the stuff of the session. As such, even though there are certainly cognitive and behavioral aspects to EMDR, I would argue that it is essentially a depth psychology approach simply due to the material which it brings up. I do think it is therefore an example of the confluence occurring in psychology which you have referred to on various occasions. Best wishes, James." So, James, my friend, I want to thank you for posting that comment on the site and for clarifying that and going into it a bit more deeply. I'll read one more. This one is from Jeff Stiles. I might have read this one before. I'm not sure. No harm in reading it again, though, if I did. Jeff writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thank you for your response." I guess I responded to him via email. And he writes, "I hope that you're feeling better soon." In parentheses, he says, "Don't these coals know what a dent they make in our productivity?" And so I guess I had a cold even back then when I first responded. He goes on to say, "I would be very pleased if you shared my letter with your audience as well as your friend Jerry. I'm heartened by your encouragement and have taken the step of inviting my Facebook contacts to engage in an informal study using the protocols outlined in my correspondence. I'll be sure and share the results if I get enough participants." Now, I should mention that he had previously written that he noticed a improvement in his mood as a result of exploring different cities using Street View and just kind of wandering around cities. And I thought that was a very intriguing notion. So in this email, he goes on to say, "I do think that I'm onto something here. Subjectively speaking, there's a certain kind of delight that is associated with rounding a corner in Street View and discovering something new and impressive. Because I am the active agent in the process, my mind seems to claim it as a kind of personal accomplishment. As noted earlier, the effect is rather long-lasting. This makes me suspect that a meaningful alteration in brain chemistry has taken place. In case you get time to dabble with Google Street View, here's how to utilize it. It can be accessed by going to the following URL." And he gives the URL of www.maps.google.com. "If you drag and drop the little orange person icon appearing in the upper left-hand corner of the map to a point on the map that is supported by a blue highlighted path, then you will, quotes, be there. You can then navigate and advance via the markers on the ground. I look forward to hearing if any other people derive the same positive effects that I do from the activity. Kindest regards, Jeff Stiles." And so I did follow Jeff's advice and experiment with it, but only a little bit. And I actually went to old places. I went to the childhood home that I mostly grew up in and to my grandparents' house where I mostly grew up. And those were the areas that I explored. And I really want to try you. And I also went to Australia. I think I went to Melbourne. or maybe it was Sydney, and I tried, quotes, walking around there a bit, and I found myself in this very sort of normal strip mall kind of area that I could have been in the U.S. So it wasn't particularly uplifting, but I realized that it could be quite useful for exploring vacation areas that one plans to go to or conference areas that one plans to go to get the lay of the land, or to go to vacation areas that one maybe won't be able to go to for one reason or another, maybe for reasons of handicap or expense or lack of time, and kind of get some sense that you have been there. So I just need to devote more time for those sorts of explorations, and I encourage you to take Jeff's suggestion and report back to us how it turned out for you. So with that, I better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Dr. Monica Wickman for sharing her work with us on phenomena surrounding death and her very personal stories, which I really appreciated. My next guest, as you heard earlier, will be Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, who founded the Trauma Stewardship Institute, where she works with those who have become traumatized as a result of their work with trauma victims. So that will be very interesting. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.